From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
El candidato que obtuvo más votos en la elección de presidente de los Estados Unidos Mexicanos fue el ciudadano Felipe de Jesús Calderón Hinojosa.
Mexico's top electoral court declares conservative candidate Felipe Calderón the winner of Mexico's disputed presidential elections. His rival Andrés Manuel López Obrador says he will never recognize the result and vows to form a parallel government. We'll go to Mexico City to get the latest. Then as Camp Democracy opens on the National Mall in Washington, we'll speak with a father who lost his son in Iraq 2 years ago. When Marines came to his home to inform him his son had died, he destroyed their van in a frenzy and accidentally set it, as well as himself, on fire, burning 30% of his body. We'll speak with Carlos Arredondo and his wife, Melita. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Mexico's top electoral court has declared conservative candidate Felipe Calderón the winner of the country's disputed presidential election over Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The head of the Electoral Tribunal, Leonel Castillo González, made the announcement.
The candidate that obtained the most votes in the election of the President of the United States of Mexico was citizen Felipe de Jesús Calderón Hinojosa. Second, the presidential elections of the United States of Mexico are valid.
The tribunal acknowledged there were election irregularities and errors, but the court ruled Calderón's victory stands. López Obrador says he will never recognize Calderón's presidency and vowed to form a parallel government. He's planning to hold a massive rally in Mexico City September 16th, Mexico's Independence Day, to set up his shadow government. We'll go to Mexico for more in a few minutes. President Bush warned Tuesday pulling troops out of Iraq would help Osama bin Laden establish a totalitarian Islamic empire stretching from Europe to North Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. In the speech, Bush repeatedly quoted bin Laden's own words and compared him to Adolf Hitler.
Bin Laden and his terrorist allies have made their intentions as clear as Lenin and Hitler before them. The question is, will we listen? Will we pay attention to what these evil men say? America and our coalition partners have made our choice. We're taking the words of the enemy seriously. We're on the offensive. We will not rest. We will not retreat. And we will not withdraw from the fight until this threat to civilization has been removed.
President Bush also vowed to stay the course in Iraq.
These evil men know that a fundamental threat to their aspirations is a democratic Iraq that can govern itself, sustain itself, and defend itself. They know that given a choice, the Iraqi people will never choose to live in the totalitarian state the extremists hope to establish. And that is why we must not and we will not give the enemy victory in Iraq by deserting the Iraqi people.
On Tuesday, the White House released an updated version of its national strategy for combating terrorism. Despite President Bush's claim Iraq is the central front on the war on terrorism, Iraq is only mentioned 9 times in the 29-page document. Hours after President Bush's speech, ABC News revealed Pakistan has reached a peace agreement with pro-Taliban fighters on the Afghan border. As part of the deal, Pakistan agreed to pull out troops from the Taliban stronghold of North Waziristan. In addition, Pakistani army plans to return captured Taliban weapons and prisoners. One Pakistani official told ABC the army would not capture Osama bin Laden if he agreed to lead a peaceful life. Former White House terrorism czar Richard Clark said the deal indicates the Taliban and al-Qaeda leadership have effectively carved out a sanctuary inside Pakistan. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf is meeting today with Afghan President Hamid Karzai in Kabul. A new book has revealed former undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame was the chief of operations and the CIA's joint task force on Iraq at the time of her outing 3 years ago. According to journalists David Korn and Michael Isikoff, Plame was part of a secret CIA team that was mounting espionage operations to gather information on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. The Joint Task Force on Iraq was trying to find evidence that would back up the White House's assertion that Iraq was a WMD danger. Plame was forced to leave her position after her identity was leaked. In New York, a major new health study has found nearly 70% of first responders at Ground Zero suffer from chronic lung ailments. The report by Mount Sinai is the largest ever done of 9/11 health effects. For the past 5 years, city, state, and federal officials have downplayed the health dangers of the toxic dust that was released when the World Trade Center collapsed. Last week, the city issued guidelines for doctors on how to spot and treat illnesses related to Ground Zero. The city was widely criticized for taking nearly 5 years to release the guidelines. On Tuesday, Mayor Mike Bloomberg announced the city will begin providing health treatment to anyone sickened by Ground Zero contaminants. Spanish National Radio is reporting that a lawsuit is being filed today in Spain's high court against Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. He's being accused of committing crimes against humanity for ordering military attacks on civilians in Lebanon and Gaza. In recent days, Israel's foreign ministry has expressed concern that senior Israeli military and governmental officials could be prosecuted overseas for committing war crimes in Lebanon. Israeli legal experts say some officers or government officials who traveled to Europe stood the risk of being arrested. Meanwhile, the Lebanese government has filed an official complaint with the UN Security Council to protest Israel's continued air and sea blockade of the country. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says he hopes Israel will soon lift the blockade.
We are working that problem very hard. It's been one of the issues on my agenda right from the beginning, and I know it's extremely important for the Lebanese government and for the people of the region. I don't want to raise any false hopes, but I hope within the next 48 hours we will have some news on that.
Meanwhile, a pair of roadside bombs exploded Tuesday outside the Lebanese city of Sidon. Four people died in the blast. Injured in the attack was a senior Lebanese intelligence officer named Samir Shahadi. He has played a leading role in Lebanon's investigation into last year's killing of former Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri. In other news from Lebanon, Turkey has pledged to contribute troops to the international peacekeeping force. In Ankara, over 10,000 Turkish protesters gathered to condemn the move. Protesters carried banners that read, "We won't be the soldiers of the United States and Israel." Turkey's announcement has also been criticized by members of the Lebanese Armenian community. This is Kajak Tarpinian.
Against for Turkish army to come here, of course, the Armenian people, they have very big problems. They killed many Armenians, not only Armenians in Lebanon also. Before, they did many massacres, not only for the Armenians, for Lebanese people also. And I think that there will be very bad things when Turkish army come here.
The Iraqi National Assembly has voted to extend Iraq's state of emergency by another month. Iraq's been under a state of emergency since November 2004. The U.S. military announced the deaths of three more U.S. soldiers. Eight American and two British troops have died over the past 3 days. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is drawing a parallel between the Iraq War and the U.S. Civil War. In an interview with Essence magazine, Rice said, quote, "I'm sure that there were people who said, why don't we get out of this now, take a peace with the South, but leave the South with slaves." Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has authorized the construction of nearly 700 new homes and settlements in the occupied West Bank. Here in this country, federal prosecutors have asked a New York judge to sentence attorney Lynn Stewart to 30 years in prison. Lynn Stewart was convicted in 18 months ago of providing material support to terrorists by releasing a statement by her client, Sheikh Ahmed Abdulrahman. She's scheduled to be sentenced next month. Her lawyers have argued Stewart should receive no prison time, arguing a harsh sentence would frighten other lawyers from representing notorious clients. In Detroit, Michigan, a citywide teacher strike has entered its ninth day. Tuesday was supposed to be the first day of classes, but the school system was forced to cancel classes. Last month, the teachers' union rejected a two-year contract proposal that sought 5.5% wage reductions and co-pays for health care benefits of up to 20%. In other labor news, the computer giant Intel has announced plans to slash over 10,000 jobs, or about 10% of its workforce. In environmental news, a new study has found the rapid rise in greenhouse gases over the past century is unprecedented in at least 800,000 years. Scientists said air bubbles trapped in ice for hundreds of thousands of years have revealed that humans are changing the composition of the atmosphere in a manner that has no known natural parallel. And in news from Washington, the Justice Department has launched an investigation into whether former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay's wife illegally received money from a lobbying firm. Christine DeLay was on the payroll of the Alexander Strategy Group, but it's unclear if she actually did any work there. She earned $115,000 over a three-year period. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday, Mexico's top electoral court declared conservative candidate Felipe Calderón the winner of the disputed presidential elections. The ruling comes 2 months after voters first cast their ballots in Mexico's closest race ever. Initial results showed Calderón narrowly beat rival Andrés Manuel López Obrador, but there were widespread allegations of electoral fraud. For the past 2 months, supporters of López Obrador have engaged in mass protests calling for a vote-by-vote recount. Yesterday, the Federal Election Tribunal rejected those allegations, though they acknowledged what they called election irregularities and errors. The court said they were not enough to conclude that the election should be annulled. López Obrador has said he will never recognize Calderón's victory and has vowed to form a parallel government. We go now to John Ross, author of many books about Mexico. His latest is Making Another World Possible, Zapatista Chronicle 2000-2006. John's most recent article about the Mexico elections is on the website counterpunch.org. He joins us from Mexico City. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Hi, Amy. How are you doing?
Good. Can you talk about the announcement of the Federal Election Commission that it's Calderón who'll be the next president of Mexico?
Yeah, the decision itself is quite illogic. Illogical, I guess, would be the word. When we take a look at what they said, they actually declared that President Vicente Fox, who is from the same party as Felipe Calderón, of course, illegally and perhaps unconstitutionally interfered in the election and placed the election at risk. That's their words. He placed the election at risk. That several business confederations that had sponsored a long and very very prejudicial hit spot campaign, spots, television spots that went on for months that called López Obrador a danger to Mexico, had illegally sponsored them, that they were not empowered to actually contribute to the airing of those commercials. They subtracted thousands of votes, 10,000 votes, from Calderón's totals, bringing him down to 233,000 vote advantage out of 42 million votes cast, which indeed is less than the number of votes that the Trife annulled 2 weeks ago in a partial recount of less than 10% of the 130,000 ballot boxes. That were 130,000 ballot boxes that were utilized on July 2nd in the election. And yet their decision was, as you just mentioned, that none of these factors affected the final results of the election and that Felipe Calderón was the new president. And of course, the decision was designed, I think, in the end, to try and bring together some sort of reconciliation of the political forces that are extremely polarized at this particular point. But it's very clear that it's just going to prolong the struggle over the next 6 years as Calderón tries to rule.
We're talking to John Ross, regular contributor to The Nation, Counterpunch, the Mexican daily La Jornada. Can you talk about who was at Calderón's rally last night and who was at López Obrador's?
Calderon spoke to the country last night, actually, on television. Most of his campaign has really been a kind of a spot campaign, and he doesn't bring together a lot of people. They have a first large gathering, I think, set for September 10th. So most of his communication was by electronic media. López Obrador, of course, has for the last, since July 30th, has sponsored or put together an encampment that stretches for about 5 miles through the heart of Mexico City. Tens of thousands of people are encamped there and continue to be encamped there, and they were once again every night at 7 o'clock. López Obrador has conducted what is called an informative assembly, despite a driving rainstorm, which seems to have been the norm here for the last couple of months. Tens of thousands of people were in the Zócalo, extremely angry and trying to figure out what the direction of the campaign and López Obrador's campaign continues, what the direction of that campaign is going to be.
We're also joined on the telephone from Mexico City by Gilberto López Rivas, an anthropologist with the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico City, a frequent contributor to the Mexican newspaper La Jornada. Your assessment of this announcement of President Calderón?
Well, I agree with John Ross. I think that this is the beginning of a new form of confrontation and struggle in Mexico after this tribunal announcement of Calderón as elected president of Mexico. I think that we have already many organizations, persons, intellectuals who are declaring, including myself and a great number of intellectuals in Mexico, that we are not going to recognize Calderón as a legitimate president in Mexico, and that we will go into resistance for this government that for us do not fulfill all what is a fair and transparent election. I think that the tribunal behavior was that of a corrupted and state mentality that confirmed that the election was a fraud. So Ross mentioned the anger of the people, and that's true. There are a lot of anger in too many people. And that, together, is what we call a kind of a rebellion, an insurrection, civil insurrection, if you want. But I expect in the years to come a great confrontation, and that Calderón is not going to be a president accepted by millions of Mexicans.
John Ross, the State of the Union address that Fox, the president now, Vicente Fox, was not able to give, can you describe the scene, what happened in the parliament?
Yeah, I think it's kind of I've got a long narrative up on Counterpunch that'll probably fill you out, but really it was a situation in which the 155 representatives, senators, and deputies from the Coalition for the Good of All, from the three parties that have participated in López Obrador's campaign, took the tribune in Congress. They occupied the tribune and refused to leave until troops that had been surrounding the Congress for 2 weeks previous and large metal barricades, 6,000 troops, snipers up on the roofs, until they had all been removed, saying that this was a violation of the Constitution. It was clearly a violation of the Mexican Constitution. And Fox was not able to enter into the chambers to pronounce the political speech that goes with his annual State of the Union address. He had to, in fact, hand his address to the Secretary of Congress and leave. And then an hour later, rushed back to Los Pinos, the Mexican White House, was brought into the television studio there. and was able to read his political message. It was kind of intercut with pictures of smiling Indians and smiling school children. And in fact, the informed me the State of the Union message was reduced to what I say, it was an infomercial, what we call a commercial or infomercial. I think in many respects, this has been going on for a number of years, since 1988, when the PRD, then in formation, cheated out of the election of Cuauhtemoc Cardenas, interrupted the speech of the president, Miguel de la Madrid, every year. The PRD has expressed its opposition during this annual State of the Union address, and it is completely eroded this really kind of ceremonial, empty, pompous ceremonial event that is really dedicated to the aggrandizement of the president over the other two houses of government here. And this was actually the final, the coffin nail here for this kind of event each September 1st. And it showed the rest of the nation the great anger and in fact, the commitment to resistance on the part of the congressional delegation of these three parties. We hope that they will stand together. That it remains to be seen how long this unity between those three parties is going to exist in the new Congress. I think we are going to see Calderon as president try to split this coalition, to buy off the deputies and senators, and to diminish the force of López Obrador's deputies and senators in the new Congress.
I want to ask Gilberto the significance of September 16th, the major protest day, also Mexico Independence Day.
Well, there is the idea that the convention will be the beginning of a civil resistance movement, and we expected to have about a million delegates to that convention. But besides this movement, there are important processes that we have to take into consideration, like, for example, what is happening in Oaxaca, and also the other campaign of the Zapatista movement. And something that it is not taking into account in the analysis, that is the armed group, are demonstrating in many manifestos during these days. I think these four movements or processes have to take into consideration in the next years to come. Two forces that could be in certain moment together or separated, but that are going to be the opposition movement in the next years. So the convention could be something that go into a kind of a shadow government, but the fact is that this is going to be the beginning of a new form of protest and resistance that are going to avoid all kind of good governance by the part of Calderon.
Finally, John Ross, the role of U.S. companies in this election. You wrote an article in 2005, for example, about Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Well, Walmart, Halliburton, how about that? Kraft, a whole list of U.S. transnationals in this election are part of what is called a Council of Communication that indeed were the people that sponsored the spots, the hit spots against López Obrador over many months, and it was a clear intromission in the Mexican election by transnational corporations.
Were these spots that had, for example, Hugo Chavez, Castro, and López Obrador together?
Subcomandante Marcos, Hugo Chavez. We had spots of the city falling down. They were scare spots, and they always wound up with a big red letters imprinted on the screen that said that López Obrador was a danger to Mexico. No, and it's been clear from the beginning that the U.S. corporations backed Felipe Calderon. That Calderon has promised, in fact, to privatize PEMEX, the national oil a monopoly. Halliburton is here, and they definitely have, want a piece of that. A lot of U.S. corporations want a bigger piece of what used to belong to the Mexican people, what used to belong to the Mexican state. And so they're siding with Calderon, and their actual financing of the campaign was very obvious. Dick Morris, famous Dick Morris, right-wing Fox commentator, was designed a lot of those hit spots. And it was clear that the White House and the State Department were very quick to recognize Calderon. In the first days after the election, George Bush called Calderon from Air Force One. We, again, yesterday had the State Department reiterate that support of Calderon. And they clearly, from the beginning, the Ambassador Tony Garcia here has made statements that were definitely in support of Felipe Calderon presidency. They've got that now, and let's see what they can do with it, because for the next 6 years, it's going to be very difficult for Felipe Calderon to run this country.
John Ross and Gilberto Lopez-Rivas, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Professor Lopez-Rivas, anthropologist, National Institute of Anthropology in Mexico City. John Ross, regular contributor to The Nation, Counterpunch, as well as a Mexican daily, La Jornada, and has written a number of books in Mexico, among them Rebellion from the Roots, The Annexation of Mexico, and also The War Against Oblivion, just completed Making Another World Possible, Zapatista Chronicle 2000 to 2006. That'll be published in October. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, a couple in Massachusetts who lost their son in Iraq. They head to Camp Democracy tomorrow on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos. 10 años pasaron ya. En que crucé de mojado y papeles no he arreglado. Sigo siendo un ilegal. Tengo mi esposa y mis hijos, que me los traje muy chicos y se han olvidado ya de mi México querido, del que yo nunca me olvido y no puedo regresar. ¿De qué me sirve el dinero si estoy como prisionero dentro de esta gran nación? Cuando me acuerdo hasta lloro, que aunque la jaula sea de oro, no deja de ser prisión.
Escúchame.
Los Tigres del Norte, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the second year in a row, people convened in Crawford, Texas this August as President Bush took his late summer vacation. The gatherings called Camp Casey, named for the son of anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan. Casey Sheehan died in Iraq on 40404. That's April 4th, 2004. On Tuesday, Camp Casey followed the president back to Washington, D.C. to launch a new protest gathering, Camp Democracy. It's taking place over the next few weeks on the National Mall. In addition to the Iraq War, the event will also focus on other social justice causes at home and abroad. Events will be held around the rights of immigrants, workers, women, voters, victims of Hurricane Katrina. On Friday night, as we began our 80-city Breaking the Sound Barrier tour here at Democracy Now!, we pulled up to Provincetown High School in Massachusetts. In front of it stood a man and his wife with a coffin. Hanging off the coffin was an army jacket. Next to it were army boots. It was Carlos Arredondo and his wife, Melita, in front of that coffin. They told me about their son, Alexander, who died 2 years ago in Najaf, Iraq, on Carlos's 46th birthday. Carlos is heading to Camp Democracy later today. The couple lives in Walpole, Massachusetts. Carlos and Melita join us today from a studio in Boston. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, Carlos, you became a national story, horrifying as it is to say that, 2 years ago, when you learned of your son's death, who was killed August 25th, 2004. Can you talk about that day and where you were?
Yeah, that day was my 46th birthday. And my 44th birthday, I was in Hollywood, Florida, And I was expecting the phone call from my son Alexander, who he never missed a call for my birthday. And pretty much I was outside my house waiting for my wife to come home to celebrate my birthday. My mother was at the house. And next thing I know, the three U.S. Marine casualty team came to my house, and they pretty much parked in front of my house. And for a moment, I thought it was a surprise from my son, Alex. I thought he was home. And next thing I know, they are telling me my son, Alexander, last Corporal Alexander Arredondo, was killed in Iraq. And no scripts for that kind of news, no scripts for that kind of situation. I pretty much spent almost half hour to asking three different times the U.S. Marine team to leave my house. They never was prepared about this situation. They never asked me to come inside the house. They never support me or help me mentally, because I ran around the house. I asked three different times to leave my house, and they still not leave my house. My second time that I attempt to leave, I walk out with a hammer, 5 pounds hammer, to pretty much ask them to leave my house. Otherwise, I destroy the van, and still nothing happened. My third time, almost half hour later, I asked them to leave my house. And at that time, you know, I walk out with 5 gallons of gasoline, a propane torch, and I start destroying the U.S. Marine van that was in front of my house with a hammer, and destroy everything, threw everything all over the place, and pour it with gasoline, and then open the gas propane torch, in which the van blew up with myself inside. Luckily, I was near the driving side door, which explosion threw me out to the street on fire. And I get 26% of my body burned, and I'm still suffering that consequences. But I'm going to speak it.
Your mother had tried to pull you out of the van before it lit, and that set off the torch in your hand?
That's correct. My mother was the whole time was in the door screaming and yelling for help. And she doesn't speak English, but she was yelling so loud, you know, anybody can for the help that she was asking. Nobody was around. The Marines was in the same spot the whole time. When I tried to reach the driver's side door, because the fumes or the gasoline was very strong, I cannot breathe. Pretty much that's when my mother reached into my hand and pulled me up, tried to pull me out. That's when I pressed the button with ignited the flames. That's when the explosion occurred.
And at that point, as we turn to your wife, Melita, at that point, Melita, you were just pulling up in the car?
That's right. I had just turned the corner to the house, and I saw ahead something on fire, and I was perplexed. And I thought it was a house, and then I approached, I saw it was a van, then I realized the van was in front of my home, and then on the other side of the street, I saw my husband with a Marine sitting on top of him, and my husband was burned.
What happened next?
I pulled up. I tried to stop the car right in front, but the Marines said to me, no, 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 go, go. The van's going to blow. The van's going to blow. So I had to drive the car to the corner and then run back, and the van did blow two or three times. And as I approached Carlos, the thing that I noticed the most was his skin. He also had a shirt over his eyes with the Marine on top of him. The shirt was, like, over his head. And I tried to relax Carlos as much as possible, saying, relax, relax, okay, calm down, calm down. And finally, the Marine let go, and we got the shirt out from over his head, because my husband couldn't really breathe very well between the pressure and the smell of the smoke and everything. He did have some smoke inhalation. And at that point, we were surrounded by helicopters, press, ambulances, fire trucks, neighbors. It became sensational within seconds. My mother-in-law said, hear the phone, it's Brian, it's Brian. She said it in Spanish. And Brian is my younger stepson, and he was with his mom in Maine. during that period, and he asked, "Where's Dad?" And I said, "Oh my God, Brian! Oh my God! Turn on the TV! Turn on the TV!" He did. He said, "What's going on? There's Dad! There's Dad!" It was being shown live in Maine, as it was all around the country. And I'm saying to him, "Yes, your father lost it. He couldn't deal with it. You know, Alex is gone, and I'm sorry, Brian." He said, "Well, Brian was." Basically, almost crying, and he said, "Well, I called to wish Dad a happy birthday."
And Brian then was 17 years old?
At that time, he was 16.
16. We're talking to Melida and Carlos Arredondo. 2 years ago, Carlos's son, Melida's stepson, died in Najaf in Iraq. That was 2 years ago, Carlos. After that, what happened? Did you start speaking out right away? How long did it take you? And how long has it taken you to heal physically? And then we can talk about emotionally.
Well, pretty much, you know, it took some time, you know, just to deal with the mourning and Alexander's death and also the issue about me, you know, being an American citizen. I am a legal resident, and so I was trying not to get in trouble with that issue because I might be deported. At the time when I was in the hospital, I thought I was going to be ended up in Guantanamo because, you know, I pretty much target a U.S. government property, and all that was taken care of. I'm still speaking out. Pretty much, almost a year later, we started speaking out. And when the 2000 casualty, whose name was Alexander also, that's when pretty much I put together my display. I've been going cross-country, bringing to cities and towns, to Washington, to the Congress, and everywhere I can, like that, can people have a little bit of feelings about all this nonsense war.
Carlos, before we talk about the coffin that you take around the country, I wanted to go back to this issue of you being a legal resident, an immigrant from Costa Rica?
Correct.
Now, you've applied for citizenship, but have not gotten it even after your son died in Iraq?
No, because the reason is everybody got away in line, and when I moved from Massachusetts to Hollywood, Florida, I ended up moving my documents to my new stay, and so I ended up going to the last of the list in line. And then when I moved back to Massachusetts for my son Barry also to come back to Massachusetts, my citizenship application ended up being in once again in line, in the battle line or all those applications they are waiting. And at this point, I'm not too sure what my number is right now in that line.
I'm looking at a letter. At Provincetown High School, you had the coffin in the back of a pickup truck. You had the Army jacket, the Army boots of your son, Alex. And you have a whole display in a notebook of different letters. Among them is a letter from Alex that he wrote from sea as he was being shipped out to Kuwait, dated January 19th, 2003, right before the invasion. He writes, "I'm not afraid of dying. I'm more afraid of what will happen to all the ones I love if something happens to me." When did you receive that letter?
Well, we received that letter. That was his first letter home mm-hmm. on the way to war. He was being transported in the Dubuque, this naval ship that was on the way to Kuwait. And pretty much as soon as I received that letter, I started sharing that letter to friends and family and people that crossed my way to let him know he can support Alex by writing them back. And pretty much I started then sharing these feelings and emotions.
But you ask an interesting question, Amy. Actually,
yes, Melida.
There's a lot of communication blackouts. And at the beginning of the war, I'm sure we weren't the only anxious family in the United States. We didn't hear from Alex. So that letter was not the first communication. He wrote it before the war as he was on the USS Dubuque. But what we actually heard first was Alex's voice on an NPR radio show by John Burnett. And it was totally a coincidence. We were on our way to walk our dogs in a local park, and the radio came in, and we were listening because it was about Iraq, and then all of a sudden John Burnett said, and here I am with Lance Corporal Alex Arredondo. Oh, my goodness. That was early March, mid-March, and then the letter arrived late March.
We're going to break. When we come back, I want to ask you about Brian, your younger son, who, as we talked on Friday night in Provincetown, Massachusetts, not that far from Walpole, where you live, you said is being aggressively recruited himself, now 19 years old, by the National Guard. We're talking with Melita and Carlos Arredondo. They lost their son 2 years ago, August 25, 2004, in Najaf. Carlos heads today to Camp Democracy in Washington, D.C. He'll be one of the first people to speak tomorrow on the National Mall. Stay with us.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. The headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fan the flame. To those wars that are fought in places their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friend? These governments killing their own. Or is it the ones who can't take anymore? So they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone. They're alive in the balance.
Richie Havens, Lives in the Balance, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined in Massachusetts by Carlos and Melita Arredondo, lost their son, Alex, Corporal Lance Corporal Alexander S. Arredondo, killed in Najaf August 25, 2004. Carlos, you have been pulling a coffin, whether in a pickup truck, as I saw you in Provincetown, or across the Capitol in Washington, D.C., in Waco and Crawford, you just came from. The coffin that symbolizes the death of your son. Can you talk about this display that you carry and all that you have in it?
Well, I'm trying to honor my son, Alexander. I'm trying to do as personal as I can. I cannot speak up for any other family. But also, I want to remind the American people for all those fallen heroes that we already lost, the American fallen heroes. At the same time, when I speak, I remind people all the people who've been killed in Iraq, remember them and honor them and do something about this nonsense war. I also want people to understand and remember the NATO forces. We almost have 250 NATO forces from El Salvador, Australia, England, Spain, you know, all these people who sacrificed their life, and we need to remember them. And the way I'm going around the country, from the West Coast to the East Coast, letting know people what the situation happened to me in this case, how my son was recruited, how the notification team deal with my situation, how it's been for ourselves. Not all the families in this country, the Gold Star family speaking out, it's very hard for them to come out and deal with the situation. But in my case, in Massachusetts, we have two families right now speaking out. The Lucy's family and the Arredondo family right now, we are working very hard to share our story to the American people. We have more than 50 casualties right now in Massachusetts. On Wednesday, we buried one more soldier here at home. Just last night, we lost one more soldier in Iraq from Massachusetts. And this getting out of hand, and we don't even know the number in Iraq and Afghanistan or the citizen that's been killed. And my purpose on me traveling around the country is to letting know people that we are fighting an immoral war. This administration has been pretty much doing their own thing, their own way. And I'm coming for a third world country, Costa Rica. Right there, we have a free care for all. All by selling bananas and coffees, a school for all the kids. So I'm meeting with senators and congressmen to let them know there is something wrong with that picture, because being for a third world country, we can handle that situation. Why can this country cannot do it? Also, one of the messages I got from people in the Congress, senators and congressmen, is pretty much that we need to wrap this up together and let them know the American people that we need to vote. 5% of the American people is what we have in the world, and when they make the wrong mistake, everybody in the world pay the big price. And right now, everybody paying the price for this nonsense war.
One of the things you showed me was a letter from the Army National Guard, and I wanted to read an excerpt of it that came to your son Brian. It begins, "Dear American," and it starts off by talking about why it's important to be in the National Guard to serve in situations like Katrina, interestingly enough, where people said the National Guard didn't show up because they were in Iraq. But it goes on to say, you could be eligible for an enlistment bonus of up to $20,000 for joining the Army National Guard. What can you do with $20,000? A new car? Pay off credit cards? Help your family? It's up to you. It'll be your money, money earned by making a commitment to serve your country. Remember, the decision you make right now will have a huge impact on how the rest of your life turns out. Melita, I wanted to ask you about this letter and about the recruitment of your younger son, of Brian.
Brian was planning to be a Marine. He always looked to Alex for guidance and wanted to follow his big brother's footsteps. Obviously, with losing Alex, he's really questioned that decision. At this point, Brian has not continued with high school yet. He has not completed it. However, the military has changed the rules, and you do not have to have a high school diploma or a GED anymore. You can earn it by going into the military and getting it after a period of time. However, Brian and I and his dad and everybody who knows him have spoken to him long about this. And one of the things that I pointed out to him is Alex trusted his brothers-in-arms and Uncle Sam to take really good care of him. Alex did everything right, and still he was killed. Alex was killed by a shot to the left temple. It calls to question, he did have his helmet on. It calls to question the adequacy of the gear that he had on. And that really got Brian thinking, along with all the other conversations that people he had with other people. Brian tells me that he's received items from recruiters in malls, on the streets. He has hats, backpacks, lighters. They've gone all out in their marketing, and Brian pretty much has a pretty big collection of items that have been given to him to try to get him interested.
Let me ask you about Brian. Carlos, how would you feel if he decided to enlist?
Well, it's a law that covers Brian for not to go there, but that doesn't mean that he cannot join if he want to. Of course, if he want to, I just go and try to do my best for him not to go. And pretty much I'm telling him he knows what we're doing. I'm telling him the tactics the government was using on young girls and kids seduce them. They say volunteer by calling seducing. They seduce them with all these gizmos and all these offers of money and all that. They walking around high schools, and everybody know how the tactics are, pretty much. And pretty much I'm telling Brian how they pretty much been targeting now the immigrants. You know, the immigrants right now has been offered that kind of money and also the citizenship. And we already have a big number of immigrants who are fighting right now in Iraq for the citizenship. So me helping Brian by giving this information, I just hope he not to go there. But if he feel the need for him to go there as a father, I will support him all the way, and God protect him and myself, and I just hope for him to make the right choice and not to go.
Melita, how is Brian doing? He's 19 now, lost his role model, his big brother.
Brian himself says, you know, I'm bored equals depressed. He's had a hard time holding a job. And he hangs out on the block, as I call it, with his pals or whatever. Last week, I was with him and a friend, and his friend has taken the ASVAB, which is the exam to go into the military. And that has me concerned, because now his friends are his role models. Brian has told Carlos that he does not want to go in because he doesn't want to see the same thing happen to his family that happened, you know, when Alex was killed. However, you know, he's at an age where his friends mean a lot to him. And finding out that this friend was interested in going into the Army did not make me feel as good about it as previously.
You live in Walpole, Massachusetts. It's known for the big prison there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, we live in Roslindale, but that's where Alex is buried.
When I spoke to you on Friday night, you talked about your concerns about the options for young people, particularly young people of color right now.
Yeah. The block, as we call it. I live in Dorchester. I work in Roslindale. It's part of the city of Boston. Brian is basically hanging out and in different parts of town, and there's been a lot of violence this year in the city of Boston and outlying areas. Unfortunately, Boston now has been cast as a high place for crime. There were 7 murders in 7 days in the city of Boston, right in the vicinity where I work and where my family and I often are together doing different events. And it has us all concerned. Brian and Alex are both have always said, don't worry, we'll be fine. There's no way we can't worry about this. I believe that we know that there are 3 things that recruiters look for. People who are low income, people of Hispanic descent, and people who come from single female-headed households. I found out this information with my husband from the GAO website after Alex was killed.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We will certainly continue to follow events at Camp Democracy, Carlos, where you're headed today, speaking out there tomorrow. Carlos and Melita Arredondo, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and condolences on the death of your son and the death of Marine Lance Corporal Alexander S. Arredondo, who died on August 25, 2004, Carlos's 46th birthday. He died at the age of 20 years and 20 days. As we turn now to the last part of our interview with Robert Fisk, the Middle East correspondent for The Independent of London, I sat with him this weekend on Labor Day in Chicago at the Islamic Society of North America conference, where 40,000 Muslims had gathered. Robert Fisk talked about his thoughts about the ceasefire in Lebanon.
This ceasefire can't work for all kinds of reasons too boring to explain. I mean, the UN are not going to block the Syrian border. The Lebanese army have to do that, and they're not going to be able to block the Syrian border. You can't. Syria's too big a country. It's a major historical ancient nation. You can't do that. And the UN is not going to be there. I asked the UN commander, French general, personally, directly, a week ago Saturday, would he put his UN troops on the Syrian border? And he said, no, it is not in the mandate. And it's not, actually. I thought it was. I went back and looked at the mandate. He's right. They're not going to do it. And that was the commanding general in charge of he's the man in charge of the increasing FINAL UN force, UNIFIL force, and he's not going to do it. So there you go.
So who's going to fight who?
Well, the Israeli blockade will continue then, won't it? And then the Hezbollah will say, well, we'll have to stop the blockade, maybe shoot another warship. You see? At the same time, the international forces will arrive, and you'll hear all these little groupuscule insurgency from Iraq people saying, why are these foreign invader crusading troops doing in the south of Lebanon? Well, they're there as a buffer force to protect Israel. That's why they're there. If they were a buffer force to protect Lebanon, they'd be on the other side of the border inside Israel, wouldn't they? Or they'd be on both sides. But they're there to protect Israel. Israel's lost enough men, so now Europeans can die for Israel instead.
You think that?
Yeah, I think so. The sermons in Tripoli about the behavior of the West post this war are very, very lethal, red hot in a cynicism towards it. I mean, you've got to realize the influence of the Iraq war on Lebanon, both on the Shiites, of course, many of whom have relatives. I mean, most of the Hezbollah clerics actually were trained in those parts of Iraq which are now under siege. Friends of Fadlallah have been murdered in Iraq. And the Sunnis going backwards and forwards between Baghdad and Lebanon. You can fly direct on a little prop aircraft. I do it lots of times. It's called Magic Carpet Airlines, by the way, and I'm not joking. You go to Tripoli. I mean, the most extraordinary things happen in Tripoli. One young man returned from fighting in Iraq to found that the word had got back to his family and his friends that he'd been martyred. He was a martyr. He was dead, you see. He'd been killed. Martyred in quotes, as I always put it. He found all his photographs lining the streets of his district saying martyred or shahada in Iraq. And he later told a colleague of mine, he said, it was the most wonderful moment of my life to go down and rip down all the pictures of my own death. But that shows you the connections between Iraq. These are the people who will be switched around and said, now I think the Crusaders are down there rather than being over there for the time being.
I interviewed the deputy foreign Israel ambassador to the United Nations, Daniel Carmon, asking him about the civilian casualties, over 1,000 in Lebanon. He said, you can't know that. You can't know how many of these people were innocent.
Oh, well, you can. Hezbollah, despite the fact the Israelis say they didn't, Hezbollah actually published some of their casualty figures each day. It was quite remarkable. They said, we've lost two more men, and their names are so-and-so, and they had so many children, they came from this village. Isn't that amazing? First time it's ever happened that an enemy of Israel actually, as the war goes on, publishes the names of its own casualties, you know? But no, we had a pretty good idea who was dying. We had lists of names. We knew who was the age and so on. I mean, you can't say, well, this may be a Hezbollah. I mean, I don't think it's 5 years old. It's like to be a fully fledged Hezbollah member. If it's 3 years old, I doubt if it can fire a missile at a warship or an aeroplane. You know? No, we have pretty good. You know, the standards of accuracy during the Lebanese civil war were always open to question because you'd go to hospitals and they'd lost the hospital had been hit by a bomb and they'd lost their papers and it was a civil war. And but now, you know, the Israelis attacked into a country that had been rebuilt. It was pretty much modern European standards. It isn't anymore. Mobile phones work properly. Ledgers are kept. Computers keep all. You know, you can go into hospital. Unlike in America, where you're considered a vulture to prey around the hospital if you're a reporter, you go to a hospital in Lebanon and say, please come in, Mr. Fisk, cup of tea. Do you want to go to the mortuary and count the bodies? Do you want the names of the bodies? And you can pretty much see if a guy's got a green uniform on, he's a Hezbollah guy. Hezbollah have said that they had 56 dead. My friends who are close to Hezbollah, and most people in Hezbollah I know, say their actual figure is nearer to 253 Hezbollah dead. But since the civilian casualty figure was approaching, I mean, since the overall casualty figure was approaching 1,300, even if the 253 figure is not exaggerated, and I think it might be true, I saw a lot of wounded Hezbollah, quite seriously wounded Hezbollah. Even if the 253 figure is true, the number of civilians, total civilian casualties, must be in the region of 1,000.
Robert Fisk of the Independent of London. I spoke to him in Chicago on Labor Day. That does it for today's broadcast. Mark's now produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope to produce John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes. On our break, the Sound Barrier Tour will be in Milwaukee and Minneapolis and on Monday night in New York. You can call us at 212-431-9090. Thanks for joining us.